Welcome to the Masterminds podcast channel, brought to you by DonorSearch, a leader in prospect research tools and analytics, and your host, one of America's top philanthropic experts and fundraising consultants, Jay Frost.
Nathan Chappelle is one of the world's foremost experts on the intersection between artificial intelligence and philanthropy. Over the past 20 years, he has served in leadership positions within several large and complex nonprofit organizations, including City of Hope and UC San Diego, guiding fundraising efforts that have generated over $1 billion in philanthropic revenue. Today, he serves as Senior Vice President of DonorSearch Aristotle, leading a research and development division dedicated to leveraging artificial intelligence to help nonprofits harness actionable insights from big data. So Nathan, it's great to talk to you today. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, Jay, thanks so much for having me as always. Appreciate and enjoy our time together.
Well, I do want to ask you about some things we've never talked about. And I know some of them you've shared in TEDx talks and other places, but I thought we could dive into that a bit so people have a sense about who you are and what has motivated you to do some of the work that you're doing today. And I wanted to start by asking you about something you've talked about in your TEDx talk. You said that when you were six, that your father left your family and that you at that point then ran a double paper route, you cooked meals with your sister, you watched your mom work multiple jobs. I really wanted to hear more about your mom.
Yeah, well, thank you. Oh, man, I forgot that was in the TED Talk. But, you know, I mean, part of it is we are a family that didn't grow up with a lot. And in fact, I mean, we really relied on generosity of a lot of others to help support our family through a lot of hard things. And my mom and I have an older sister, essentially the three of us were just a really tight unit, did everything together. I mean, cooked, cleaned, did repairs. I mean, I'm a avid woodworker and a lot of that has to do with just having to learn what a hammer was, you know, when I was young. But essentially I think the thing that really, I think shaped me and a majority of my career, which I didn't appreciate or understand when I was going through, you know, undergrad and grad school, was that, you know, altruism was just a very big part of our growing up. And like one example was our roof on our house started to leak and essentially caved in part of it. And within a week, you know, probably 20, 30 guys from our church, you know, came over and re-roofed our house. And I learned how to roof a house. I was up on the roof with them when I was probably 10. I think you do inherit a lot of, you know, you can inherit good things and bad things from, you know, your upbringing. But in my case, you know, my mom worked three jobs growing up. I mean, she was actually a foster care parent for a while when I was really young. So I learned how to share and learn how to kind of be around others and welcome others in. But, you know, that thing of hard work is something that, as I've hired a lot of people over the years, is a quality that you don't always see in a lot of people.
Yeah. And when you described needing to pick up the hammer and do the work and getting on the roof at 10, that really speaks to, it sounds like your tight little unit, but also the community you're in. Where are you from?
Yeah. So born and raised in Southern California in a little town called Simi Valley, which is near north of LA County, where The Little House on the Prairie was filmed. So just it is what it sounds like. But it is a nice, safe environment to grow up in, very tight community. It's grown a lot since then, obviously, but definitely a place where, you know, people kind of had your back and, you know, neighbors were looking out for neighbors. And that's still very much true in my mom's neighborhood, which is kind of nice.
And you were talking about the way that people pitched in, describing that roof job almost like a barn raising. What's the first philanthropy kind of or charity related thing that you remember in your life?
You know, so it's funny because I when I was preparing for the TEDx that I did, I I don't know where I, either I found it or my mom sent it, but there was a, I ended up in the local newspaper for a fundraiser that I was either at or I was raising money for. And actually, I think it was cystic fibrosis. And I mean, I was young. I mean, it was barely the local pizza place. And it was like one of those evenings. And I did a little article in the paper and my picture is in it. And so that's probably, in fact, I don't even remember that one. The ones that actually are probably most near and dear, we started out doing work with Habitat for Humanity when I was really young. And so it was this idea, like we were always recipients of charity, but it was always an expectation that we had something to give back. And I think one of my first probably moments of pride was at a senior home. There was a home where an elderly person couldn't get up and down their stairs into their unit. And it was kind of on the fly, learning how to build a wheelchair ramp. And there were others that were older than I that helped, but I had so much pride in that experience and then seeing what it meant to the recipient. And that, you know, I mean, this is just why, you know, those that are in, you know, philanthropy, you know, it's like, of course it's nice to receive, but it's the real blessing is really in giving and seeing the difference that it makes in someone's life.
And I do want to jump into that, but I have to ask you about what happened next, because you went on and you studied business eventually. And I know you've studied a number of things, but how did your journey lead into that? And then, of course, back on the other end into philanthropy.
Certainly wasn't. In fact, frankly, college wasn't really spoken about in my household all that often. When I was, you know, finishing up, and I always had good grades in high school, but it just wasn't an option. We were pretty poor and didn't have a lot of money to, you know, options to go to college. And I didn't know about things like financial aid. And, you know, so it was one of those things where I was dating my wife now, who we've been together for 26 years. Her father was a doctor, and he essentially, we were dating in high school, and he pulled me aside one day and he just said, "Hey, you know, I like you, you know, dating my daughter is fine, but if you do, you have to go to college." And essentially they helped pay for my college. And I had no idea what I wanted to study. I hadn't really put a lot of thought into it. Like, you know, I have two high school boys now, and it's like, or college age boys now. In high school, the last few years, you're like, what do you want to do? What, you know, let's pick a school that's aligned with what your passions are and things like that. I mean, I had no idea. So I went to community college for 2 years. I took art. I took police report writing. I mean, just such a wide variety. In fact, my father-in-law said he would pay for med school if I wanted to go to med school. I tried hard and realized I was really bad at biology. And eventually took a business law class that I loved and ended up going and getting my bachelor's in business, and then eventually my MBA. It was halfway through my MBA that I discovered, I think, nonprofit as a career. And so I went back for a second master's degree in nonprofit administration, but not a straight path. I mean, I probably spent a few extra dollars and years in college aligning with what my passions were, but fortunate nonetheless.
And as you said, that's not necessarily a straight line for most people. You definitely took some really interesting and sounds like fun departures. I have to ask you about extreme sports. So yeah. What was that all about? Were you a sports guy? What is Get Boards?
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah. So, I was very fortunate. So in my undergrad, actually going back to high school, I ended up working at I don't know what you'd really call it. It was a subpoena service and investigation company that was really built around archiving, taking records for court cases and archiving them. And then in college, I did that for 5 years, actually high school and then into college. I was offered this opportunity to start a new company doing the same thing in Orange County, California. So that's what brought us to Orange County 6 months after we got married. And started this company doing digital archiving. We were really one of the first doing that. In fact, we created technology that was portable scanning at the time, which was super crazy. But my real passion was skiing. I grew up playing sports. I actually grew up playing hockey and, you know, just always active. And I was taking a trip to Vail to go skiing one winter. And there was a pair of skis that I wanted to buy, but they were made by a guy in a garage in New York, in Albany. and they weren't available anywhere. You just couldn't get them. And I thought, well, this is crazy. At the same time, I read an article about the internet and Amazon was on the verge of bankruptcy and thought, I had this crazy idea of like, what if we sold skis on the internet? And ended up being first company to sell Salomon and Rosignol skis on the internet, K2 skis, and of course, this company from New York. And so that's how that all started, getboards.com. It's still run by my best friend and my partner at the time. I sold my shares in the company to go to grad school, actually, but we're still really good friends to this day. In fact, we text all the time.
Yeah, and do you have any regrets of not pursuing more time with what sounds like a pretty fun way of making a living?
For sure. There's days where I'm like, it was hard, you know, back in the day. I mean, dot-com world, it was so much fun. You know, 96 and 97, it was essentially the Wild West. Like anything went, and I was doing SEO consulting because there were very few people doing it. I mean, it was just a blast. And, you know, it's changed a lot. But, you know, one of the things I admire so much, you have to do what you have to align your career with your kind of your work ethos and you know, your kind of your own kind of drive. And my partner is very laid back. He's just a very laid back person. And he's like, you know, let's work really hard for 3 months. And then the rest of the year, like, is paid for. And we could go mountain biking and kayaking. And I just was not wired that way. It's very hard for me to settle down. It's hard for me to relax on vacations, on weekends, things like that. And God bless him. He's still doing that. And he has a great life. And one of the things, we were together not long ago, and he said, you know, one of the things he loves about his job is that his entire job is about making people happy. They only buy things or rent things from him. And he does kayaks and mountain bikes and skis and snowboards now. And he's really in the hospitality business. And so that part of it is really alluring. That part is neat, to do something that just makes people happy. At the same time, I feel completely, you know, honored to spend 20 years working in philanthropy, where the greatest benefit is getting to know individuals that are just so generous and that want to do good beyond themselves, because it aligns with who I am. It's this idea of, you know, we is greater than me. And this idea that, you know, there's a bigger purpose than just, you know, making money or doing stuff. So I've had a very rewarding career in a lot of ways. But, you know, some days it sounds nice to go, you know, for your job to be able to go out on a kayak whenever you want, for sure.
Well, I know that you did definitely jump a full on into the world of philanthropy, because I believe from there you did start working with the Boys and Girls Club. So I know that you were able to finance additional education, which has influenced your career so much and influenced a lot of us. But you did dive into that world of BGCA. Talk about how you went there and what why you chose that and what impact it had on you.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's such a huge impact. I mean, I will say that, of course, even people that find themselves fortunate enough to work in the philanthropy business, like, there's one thing to you know, do fundraising and work with good people. There's another to do something with in a way that resonates very deeply with you. So, you know, growing up, you know, full circle here, my father-in-law, who's the doctor who'll pay for my college, founded the Boys and Girls Club in Simi Valley, where I grew up. And so lots of dots connected. And I was asked to be on the board of directors because I own my own business and was doing pretty well. And my neighbor turned out to be the president of the local Boys and Girls Club. And this happens to a lot of people, but it was probably my third or fourth board meeting where the director announced that she was leaving. She actually was moving to Idaho. And, you know, I was going to grad school and everyone looked around the table. You know, this club was really run down, didn't have a lot of resources, very little money, asked if I would step in and, you know, keep an eye on things, kind of quote unquote. And what I thought would be 7 weeks or 7 months or whatever to find somebody that would take the job, it ended up being 7 years. And I, you know, very early in that kind of job, it wasn't even a job. I wasn't getting paid. And then finally I demanded, kind of like, I'm like, if I'm going to do this, like, you've got to pay me something. It was like ridiculously low, like $30,000. And I was fortunate to have sold my business and not need a lot. And I was able to kind of use that as my philanthropy. But at the time, but man, early on, I mean, it was probably within a few months of doing this where I thought I'd go in and check in and make sure that programs were being done once or twice a week. I ended up there 6-7 days a week a lot of times. And one day I showed up in the morning, the Boys and Girls Club, and there was a kid asleep on the porch. And this is a kid named Charles that I just loved. He was just amazing, straight A student, was taking trigonometry and Japanese in his junior year of high school, type 1 diabetic, but his mother was abusive. And he had nowhere to go. And he slept on the porch of the Boys and Girls Club because it was a place for him that was safe. And man, I'll tell you what, like that just really got me. And from there, it was just this mission. There were more kids that needed to be served and more opportunities. And we started out there. I will say Boys and Girls of America, I mean, it's an incredible mission. You know, they're just very well structured. They have, I mean, the best training system of any nonprofit I've ever seen. In fact, a lot of their training was actually developed at Harvard. So this is very in-depth, intense. Like I credit so much of my fundraising and operations experience from my time at Boys and Girls Club, where you are, I mean, deep in the weeds and you kind of have to wear every hat, but you know, they prepare you to be very good at wearing all those hats, and ended up being a really rewarding career. When I was done, we had 10 Boys and Girls Club locations. We had done mergers with nearby cities. I served as a president of the whole Orange County Alliance. So representing like Disney and Boys and Girls Clubs to those Orange County, you know, corporations. So it was a great, probably the most meaningful nonprofit work I've done. I mean, it was just really great work.
I know that when you were working there, you were seeing that direct impact. You were also a person who had come from this background to some degree of working with data from that first job. And not being afraid to use technologies, clearly, with Get Boards. So did you start to see a connection, even in those early days, about utilizing new platforms or new approaches to information to make the work of every organization more effective? When did that develop for you?
You know, that's great. That's interesting insight. At the time, I think there's always been a sense that I was a fish out of water in the nonprofit world. And it's probably the reason I rose more quickly than a lot of the traditional Boys and Girls Club people who had just always worked there and they'd always done things the same way. Like I've always been an early adopter, to my detriment sometimes, but I really, you know, like I developing technology, being on the forefront of technology. At the time, you know, there, it was really about, you know, I think having the background in business. Both, you know, my undergrad and then my MBA was more, it was bringing in conversations around ROI and, you know, to board members and to, you know, people in the community. And that wasn't something that was that common. It actually, I was shunned a lot for bringing up things like ROI back in the day. I mean, it's much more common, but I mean, you've been in the field long enough to remember that, man, if you brought up things like that, 15, 20 years ago, it was like, you know, get away. Like, I mean, it was just you're kind of a pariah. It's kind of weird. So always kind of this fish out of water. I think it was just a natural, it's just who I am, is to try to either streamline processes, use the data or the assets that you have available to do things better, faster, more scalable. And so that, you know, definitely was something that, you know, I did there, you know, but really probably moving into where I had the real breakthrough in people and assets, you know, in big data. It was at UC San Diego, where I had a friend who was a PhD in econometrics on my team. And I mean, man, just the power of unlocking our work, you know, quantifying our work, but then unlocking the potential of it using data. It became something that I was pretty obsessed with and became pretty well known. And even looking at drivers for fundraising success in different types of metrics rather than just fundraising goals and things like that.
And those metrics, I know they became a big part of the development of your thinking on AI later. And didn't some of that happen when you were at City of Hope?
Yeah, so City of Hope was really where AI took off. I mean, at UC San Diego, it was really the precursor to it because we were then looking at harnessing all types of data. And I was, as a fundraising manager, looking at seeing how close we could get to predicting our future success in fundraising. So we had X number of staff, you know, 200 and something people on the team, and anyone that would walk in my office, my entire wall was filled with charts, like from like floor to ceiling, like these just visualizations of like, you know, got really good at actually predicting that we were going to hit a certain goal by the, by quantifying the activity that was going on. At City of Hope, it was kind of the inverse, still managing a fundraising team. But, you know, when I started, we had raised essentially the same amount of money for 10 years in a row. It was 130 million or 131 to be exact for 10 years in a row. I mean, and, you know, if you're talking about inflation, it's actually a declining business model. You're doing worse every year when you account for inflation. And at the same time, we knew that there had to be, you know, there's a, such a strong patient experience at City of Hope. I mean, patients, like, I mean, they're rated extremely highly as one of the best cancer hospitals in the country. You know, patients, you know, are so loyal to them, and the staff are so loyal to the patients, that there had to be a way to essentially quantify, you know, and look at individuals that were giving and the similarities of what those people had in common. So we used massive amounts of data. We ended up investing in three different AI models, and kind of ran several horses. We really never, no one really had ever done this. So we were kind of charting new territory, but we used 10 years worth of data, I mean, billions of data points, to essentially quantify like what happy patients look like and what unhappy patients look like and how that manifests itself into philanthropy or not.
And I have to ask you to define AI for those who, like myself, really don't have that grounding. So artificial intelligence, what does that really mean? And how does it apply in that kind of context?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I use that word so loosely, and it's frankly kind of a made up word. It's not made up, but it's just, it's not used clearly. So just the general sense of AI has to do with the idea that a computer can automate something that a human once did. So whether it's, you know, answering a phone, you know, in an automated call center, or typing an email for you, things like that. In our case, and what was most appropriate, and it's what my focus has been ever since, is really in the area of AI called machine learning. And machine learning is probably the biggest application of AI, because there's other areas like natural language processing that are things like Siri and Alexa that drive those components. But machine learning, it's similar to doing, you know, models, regression models that you've done in the past, except what I was really tired of was having, as a fundraising leader at the time, buying models from organizations that would take our data, they would build a model, and then they would leave. And there was kind of no recourse. And essentially, there was always this kind of influx of excitement from the fundraising team at the very beginning, like, you know, breath of fresh air, we got some new prospects from this new model. But inevitably, I was watching this from the macro kind of view, it's like 3 months later goes by, and it's like, well, you know, you start, the griping starts to continue that there's no good prospects. By 6 months, you know, it's like back, people are back to their old habits. And by 12 months, you know, everyone thinks that the model was horrible and whoever built it, you know, was horrible. The reality is it was not the model's problem. It was the fact that the model was built at a certain day and time, but because it was never rerun, it was never learning from new data, that actually it would perform worse and worse and worse. In fact, every single day that model would perform worse. While some people would become better prospects and some would become worse, the model only looked at them at one day in time from the year before. And so this idea of machine learning was pretty mind-blowing, you know, when I started, you know, really getting deep in this and learning more about what it meant. And one day, it took me longer than most, I think, to figure this out, but it was like, my gosh, we'll never have to build another model, because this model, it's a kind of the engine, and it will just continue to get better. And the more data you give it, the machine learning actually does better. It can fill in data really well. It normalizes data really well. But the idea that it's learning, it was something that just blew my mind. I'm like, we don't have to be in this like rinse and repeat cycle of like find another vendor to build another model and hope it works for a little bit of time. It's just we invest in this, and this thing will continue to grow and evolve. And, you know, I mean, and essentially, that's how the private sector that has been using machine learning for a good 10 years, the companies that make heavy uses of machine learning really start to see the greatest benefit after a few years of using it, because then it's really getting fine-tuned. It's constantly fine-tuning itself to have better and better predictions over time. But it is an investment, and you got to stay the course.
The way you've described it, it's definitely not a tool like a tool in the toolbox that doesn't change, but it's an evolving, increasingly intelligent view of what's happening as it happens. And if that's true, I'm curious about something you said earlier. Even in the most dedicated organizations where people have a lot of experience and they're willing to make changes, oftentimes it's difficult for people to evolve too. You describe people in past organizations you work with who were there for a long time and they did business the same way. Even at City of Hope, which is so distinguished, they were generating the same revenue every year. Are people not only benefiting from AI because now they have a better sense about who to talk to about what and when, but also are they evolving in relationship to the use of AI themselves? Are we getting better because of AI too?
You know, I mean, for sure, you know, at the, you know, societal level, you know, just as participants, citizens of the United States, I mean, our lives are indistinguishable from AI. I mean, AI is involved in so many facets of your life. I mean, as soon as you turn on a phone or a computer or drive a car or fly in an airplane, I mean, AI just is driving. I mean, it really is. You know, there's a quote by Andrew Ng, who started Coursera and was at Google, of course, and was like, you know, AI is the new electricity. You can't avoid it. It's everywhere. So yes, from that perspective, I will say the nonprofit sector always lags behind the private sector, and which is I studied a lot of economics, including international economics in Cambridge, and the reasons why are vast. Why that is the case, and not to the nonprofit's fault, but nonprofit sector is slow to adopt. And I will say that we have a long ways to go in terms of the nonprofit sector fully embracing AI to make things better. But I will say, I think the shift in the last, you know, 5 years, at least the last 5 years, has been a separation between the art and science of philanthropy. And I think that's something that just bothered me for my whole career. It was like meeting individuals who would fail to recognize the science part of it, that it was the art of fundraising. And the very best fundraisers are the very best because they have mastered the art of fundraising. But as a fundraising leader, for me, it was a two-sided coin. The art of fundraising, for sure. I mean, without it, you know, people wouldn't be inclined to give these, you know, these very generous gifts and feel good about it and be in partnership. The flip side of the coin was the science of fundraising management. And I think that is what in the last five, you know, maybe a little bit more than 5 years, where I've seen more nonprofits be willing to recognize the science side of it. But I still think we have a long ways to go in prioritizing the science. So it's seldom, you know, in a lot of nonprofit organizations, you see, you know, a CDO and maybe three or four or five vice presidents. It's seldom you'll find a vice president of giving sciences. You know, so I think that's where we're going. And I think you can't ignore the value of prioritizing data in any nonprofit. Are not your prospects. But people who resonate with you are your prospects, and you have to find a way to cull that down, you know, to meet the size of your team or the capabilities of your team. So I think it's shifting.
Yeah, I was going to ask you why this is important. Maybe that's the answer. If the ground is shifting and you don't want to be trying to approach everybody all the time, but instead the people who care the most or might care the most, AI would seem to be a way to do that.
I mean. Yeah, the thing that kills me is you know, and I didn't know this for the longest time, but in America, only 56% of Americans make charitable gifts. But that, which is a very significant data point, right? So 44% of the people that you trying to solicit are never going to give to you. I mean, way more than that, because they're not going to give to anybody, but they don't even know you, so they're not going to give to you. And, you know, this idea that you can convert anyone to be a donor is completely ridiculous. Like, it's just one of the most inefficient ways you could ever approach a business. It's like trying to sell a car to someone who doesn't have a driver's license. Like, it's just, you know, I mean, not where you're going to focus your effort, right? So, you know, first and foremost, like looking at some big, you know, high level data, you know, elements would be like, okay, is this person philanthropic? And that's, you know, largely found in wealth data, like through donor search. And then, you know, driving down into, you know, we know that the majority of the reasons to give for individuals are based on their experiences. And mm-hmm. so it has really very little to do with the wealth, but it has to do with their experiences. So first, you're, you know, culling it down to a reasonable number of people that potentially could give, and then trying to quantify the number of data points that exist that would make them a good donor versus someone that, you know, is committed somewhere else. So, go ahead.
From place to place, organization to organization, because I know you've talked about how there are correlations between people who have made big gifts. Are you seeing some constants as you look at vast bodies of data across lots of organizations about who might be in a position to, but also likely to make these larger gifts?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so what's been so interesting, you know, in the last several years of my career is being able to work across sectors. So religion, higher ed, and healthcare. I mean, healthcare is kind of low hanging fruit. I mean, there's somewhat of a captive audience. People go to an organization, you know, in some cases that organization saves their life, but there is a massive data trail that's very consistent, and it's captured well, that can, you know, basically be reverse engineered to determine, you know, happy people from unhappy people, or engaged people from unengaged people. But it, you know, as it turns out, is, you know, you have to get a little bit more creative. But once we started peeling back the onion and looking at higher education, I mean, there's so many data points in higher ed that speak to whether or not a student was engaged or not engaged, or happy or not happy while they were a student, that when students graduate, you don't have to treat them the same. I mean, it's crazy to think that you can. I mean, it's very, very inefficient to just treat everyone the same and start and send them the same materials and have the same people call them, because there's individuals that are just never going to give. And the data is super clear in showing that. And then it turns out in religion, while religion is not necessarily as regimented about collecting data, a lot of data points exist. And we've started working with Catholic dioceses and parishes that speak to whether or not someone's engaged, and whether it ends up not being about fundraising, it ends up being about stewarding a congregation. There are lots of telltale data points in every nonprofit that speak to whether or not a person, it's not whether they're, you know, engaged or not engaged. It's on a scale of engaged to become a donor to not engaged, and where they fall in that scale. And then what are the things that you can do to help bring them, you know, closer, or weed them out closer to becoming donors, or in most cases, solving the issue for people, the individuals that are not ever going to make a donation.
As you've looked at all this, though, is there anything that's particularly surprised you?
You know, I think it's probably the surprise has been more, you know, when we were starting to look at things at face value, it was like, well, this is kind of impossible, or, you know, there's not enough, you know, there's no data that would suggest this. And I think that's the thing. It's like, we live in a data centric world. And, you know, if you put your heads around things, and I've just had so many great conversations with people, you know, in colleges, universities, where it's like, man, like, don't you think there's a correlation between how many sweatshirts someone buys in the bookstore with the school logo on it to whether or not they're going to be, you know, score high on a alumni engagement survey and, you know, potentially become involved and be a donor. I mean, so none of those things were obvious in the beginning. In fact, a lot of them were just like, well, where do we start? I think the surprising thing when you get down to it is how many data points are collected in every type of organization that you wouldn't expect would exist. But when you start diving in, like, show me all of your data. And then the great and kind of freeing part of machine learning is that you don't have to have a hypothesis. You can set a target, and the target is to be a donor or a non-donor. It's just, it's, you know, one or the other. And this, the machine can take all the data that exists and help you determine, you know, what are the factors that are most predictive of a person being a donor. And it's not 5 or 10 or 18 or 20. It's like thousands, because data points can be predictive. They're just on a scale of how predictive they are. So it's kind of a freeing exercise. And I think that was probably, you know, and it still is actually one of the things I love the most about it. It's working to collect all the data to remove as much bias as possible. And then, you know, explore what the possibilities are. And again, it's still in the beginning stages and a lot of nonprofits, but there's a lot of very large nonprofits also that could never make sense of their data without doing something like that.
You talk about this in a way that suggests you really like to feed your brain. That should be clear from your education, the work you do. But there's more to it than that, I can tell. What is it that makes this so important right now? Why is this such a critical time in philanthropy?
Yeah, you know, I'm just like an all-in person, you know. So I got into nonprofit 20 years ago. It's like my entire ethos in life is about, you know, leaving the world a better place, you know, when I die, making some small contribution and teeny, whatever it may be, but like to make the world a better place. And, you know, for me, I worry about the nonprofit sector. I worry about this idea that we can put our head in the sand and, you know, not embrace data in a way that we can make better business decisions, or think that it desecrates the art of fundraising. I mean, I think there is a definite inflection point in the philanthropic space now. And, you know, these are formative years. And the thing I point to is Europe, and where, you know, Europe was really the birthplace of modern philanthropy, not the birthplace of philanthropy, but modern philanthropy. And it is really turned in Europe to a very transactional kind of activity that people do and they become members of. And I think the risk is for in the US to take technology and trade it for relationships. I'm very passionate about that's something that it's my personal soapbox, that technology, if we believe in philanthropy in the way that our culture in the US has actually embraced philanthropy, which is, it should be relational, then we have to use technology to help build and foster relationships. But I also see, you know, a lot of organizations just grasping at straws and they don't care how the money comes. They just want to get it. I mean, Facebook's a good example. I mean, Facebook raises lots of money for organizations, but the problem is those organizations have no idea who those donors are. So they're not able to actually build relationships with, making fundraising just very one-sided, transactional. It's something that I think will be extremely important in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years as there's kind of this awakening in the philanthropic sector about using data more intelligently.
You talked earlier about how there's been this tremendous decline in the percentage of people who were giving, and that's something I've been worried about for a long time too. We've seen a new kind of dynamic in the last 9 months. There were expectations that giving would significantly decline in the middle of the pandemic because there was so much pain and people needed to make sure that they could feed their families, pay their rent. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we've also seen increases, especially among the lion's share of the donor population. Do you think there is an opportunity now, not just with the technology, but with the way we think about interacting with and developing relationships with donors, to change this dynamic, to make it even less transactional, more relationship-based, and to do that intelligently using some of these kind of tools and approaches in order to drive more philanthropy as we come out the other end of the pandemic?
Yeah, I'm still very optimistic, and I mean, I think by nature I'm optimistic. So, I see the power of different types of technology that have improved. I mean, if you look at the private sector, types of natural language processing or other types of of AI that has actually improved customer experience in very tangible ways where, you know, people that are, you know, surveyed say, this is a better experience because this organization hears me, or I was able to connect with them in a more meaningful way. I think the potential is there. I think I'm still hopeful that we're going to learn quickly how to embrace and adopt these technologies and realize it's not a trade-off. It's not one technology over another. It's a combination of different technologies because people are complicated. And, you know, holistically, you know, there are technologies that can draft more personalized communication or steward people better. And there's technologies that can raise money better. And there's some that can provide better insight on who you should approach, you know, from a human perspective. And so still very hopeful. And I mean, the resilience of the nonprofit sector, I think, is profound. I mean, if you look historically, you know, I mean, philanthropy still remains at 2.1% of GDP. Now we'll see what 2020 ends up being. But essentially, you know, philanthropy is, because in the U.S., it is just part of, you know, what not all people do, but 56% of people do. And they're going to do that when they can do that. And that's, I hope that doesn't change. My hope is that this technology can actually solve some problems that have existed for, you know, since Aristotle. In fact, there's a new book called Philanthropy from Aristotle to Zuckerberg. And essentially these are not new issues that we've struggled with in our, in fundraising. And there's reasons why less people are giving. My hope is that, you know, with technology and embraced properly and with a longer view of building relationships, that it definitely can help get things, you know, shifted the other way.
And speaking of the longer view, I like to look back at the past to look forward to sometimes. And you started part of this conversation talking about the 10-year-old on the roof with a hammer and what it must have been like for you and your mom, especially. I'm wondering what that 10-year-old and his mom would think about the things you're thinking about and working on now.
yeah, crazy to think how, you know, time flies, but you know, I know, you know, my mom is definitely proud of the career path that I didn't choose, that it chose me. And my father-in-law who passed, who, you know, just played really formative roles in kind of shaping that and kind of encouraging it. Like I went to India in 2001 on a trip that my father-in-law paid for to do polio inoculations. And so, you know, just got to see, you know, there's just a lot of opportunity to help people out there. And so, you know, I think you make a great point. I think philanthropy starts at a young age. It's very hard to convert someone who is not, you know, allocentric in the sense that, you know, they want to, you know, versus egocentric, like that they want to do, you know, more to support those around them. But I think, you know, in younger generations, if you can instill, inspire, educate the virtues of altruism, that's really what's going to make a huge difference. And I think it's that. And I think nonprofit organizations learning how to relate better with their constituents in a more personal way, because then it becomes about a partnership, not a transaction.
Thank you so much, Nathan. Really a pleasure hearing from you on all these issues and hearing a bit more about your life and what you brought you where you are today.
Well, thanks, Jay. It's always a pleasure getting to chat with you.
The Masterminds podcast is underwritten by DonorSearch, the world leader in donor intelligence solutions for not-for-profit organizations. Our producer is Terrence Diggs. Our theme music is composed and performed by Ahmad Ibrahim. The voice introduction to our program is performed by Ryan Ibrahim. You can subscribe to the Mastermind series on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find blogs, livecasts, and flash classes with our featured masterminds at donorsearch.net or check the show notes and descriptions.